Hey everybody, welcome back to Gray Malkin Lane's Patreon channel. I am so excited to be talking about a character that I'm extraordinarily fond of for a number of reasons. And doing the research on this character really solidified a lot of my thoughts and opinions and complexities about the incredible Chris Claremont created character, Gabrielle Haller. There's a lot to talk about when it comes to Gabrielle, and I had to find just the right person. I did some searching online for someone who may have some expertise in this area academically, and I sent a weird email to the incredible Dr. Philip Smith. And Philip has graciously agreed to not only do the prep work on this character with me, but to come on the show and talk about Gabrielle with me today. Philip, let me have you introduce yourself to our listeners. Let us know your name and pronouns, and tell us a little bit about your origin story and some of your academic interests, if you would.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. Dr. Philip Smith, he, him pronouns. I'm currently based in Savannah, Georgia. My accent probably wouldn't give that away. I've lived in various different places. I've been working in academia for 8 years now as a professor and currently as department chair. My research interests are pretty eclectic, but the most relevant for what we'll talk about today is Holocaust and genocide studies and also comic scholarship. And so I did my PhD thesis on Art Spiegelman, which is a kind of the intersection of those two. But more recently, I've done work on superhero comics.
How does one land in the light and fluffy topic of Holocaust research?
So whilst I was an undergraduate, I was interested in, I think I discovered Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics. That made me realize that there is a way of talking about comics in a kind of academic sense. I'd always been a reader, but less so superhero comics. I kind of grew up reading the Beano and the Dandy, and then I'd later in life kind of discovered more sort of alternative comics, so Preacher, Sandman, and but realizing I could use Scott McCloud to write about the things I was reading anyway towards my degree was a huge revelation for me. So I did my master's degree focusing on Mouse, and that gave me access to a large amount of scholarship on Holocaust and genocide studies. And the more that I went into it, the more I felt like I think anyone who works in the humanities, there is, and particularly in English literature, there's a lot of hand-wringing and anxiety about how does what we do matter? What difference does it really make? And I find that when I'm working on Holocaust and genocide studies, that question is very easily answered. That it is really important that we talk about how we understand these events, how we articulate them, how we think about them, how they intersect with popular culture and people's understanding of history. And so it's always felt like a kind of an important place to put my energy. It always feels worthwhile in a way. You know, in other fields that I work in, I do Shakespeare scholarship, and one sometimes wonders, you know, how many people outside of school groups who don't want to be there are really kind of actively consuming Shakespeare. Whereas I feel like looking at the way that genocide is represented through popular culture, such as comics, you know, there's a huge readership, and this is a really important topic.
Yeah, so I'm going to give kind of a blanket introduction. I've been making this show for 3 years now. We have around 300 episodes, and my show has started by analyzing X-Men from the Silver Age from the very beginning. So we're focusing on a lot of the stuff because most people don't like to begin there because it's the old campy comics written for little white kids back in the early 60s, you know, leave it to Beaver era. But there has always been these themes of being different. We are the race that does not fit in. We are feared. We are fighting for our place. Magneto, as the first kind of arch nemesis of the X-Men, is the raving maniacal villain all the way from the beginning. But I love a flawed hero and I love a complicated villain. So in the 60s, it's easy just to read him as the raving madman, but there's an obsession on his part with homeland right from the very beginning. He builds a base in space because he doesn't fit among humans. He tries to conquer a country. He storms the United Nations and demands a safe place. And it's not until many years later when Chris Claremont comes aboard the book, when he adds the backstory of Magneto being a concentration camp survivor, which has been such an integral part of the X-Men from the very beginning. If you've ever read, I mean, Mouse is incredible. Magneto Testament by Greg Pak is wonderful. I've reviewed it on my show. This story did not heavily get added until the early 1980s. So it's after Claremont's been on the book for years. And this was a surprise to me, and I'm in my 40s now. I didn't learn this until 3 years ago, but Claremont based his portrayals of Charles Xavier and Magneto off of the real-life figures David Ben-Gurion and Menachem Begin, and the idea of mutant homeland as it exists, as the compromise, that may not be the right word, but the formation of Israel in the post-World War II era, and the complexities of what that means. Oversimplifying, we have this allegory revisited with Utopia, with Krakoa, with Genosha, if you're familiar with the comic storylines over the years. And we are recording this in mid-April, right after the new X-Men 97 series has just given us a cartoon portrayal of the Sentinel Massacre of Genosha, in which it's a literal genocide story taking place on the screens. And this is eliciting conversations I'm having with my children. So we read comics for fun, and these themes get very, very intermixed. We're going to be focusing most of our conversation around the character of Gabrielle Haller, who we'll introduce in just a minute. But this conversation as it exists is really interesting. I want to toss one more thing out there. The baseline for evil when it comes to Marvel Comics in particular is the Nazi Party. Most villains you can find some sort of, you know, oh, he was overlooked and has a low confidence. That's why he's robbing banks. Like, we can find some sort of heart. But when it comes to the Nazis, that's just not there. When you're writing Arnim Zola or the Red Skull or Hitler or Baron Strucker, these are the guys that are Hydra and the Sons of the Serpent and, you know, the evil, evil ones. These are the ones that there's always a rise up of these characters. Philip, I'd love to hear some of your early connections to the X-Men, if you have any. And
when I was a kid, I watched the X-Men cartoon quite a lot. I think that was my kind of initial introduction to the series.
It's wonderful. I love it.
Yes. And they've recently done another season, which is on my to-watch list, but I haven't.
That's what I just referenced. The Genosian Genocide is in that new season of the cartoon. Yeah.
I actually kind of came to superhero comics as an academic. And that can be, I think, in comic studies, I think there is a kind of interesting relationship between comic scholarship and comics fans. Because I think often comic scholars have relied historically on kind of the work of comics fans in kind of building those histories and archives. I think often the tension can be that academics have a lot of theory, but I have not read as many X-Men comics as a lot of X-Men fans, and I am very conscious of there being that kind of that the risk of my knowledge being quite narrow within the series. Just to kind of bounce off some of the stuff you were talking about, I found it interesting kind of researching and preparing for this. There's a paper by Martin Lunn on the history of Magneto, and I didn't realize before I read that that Magneto canonically been a concentration camp survivor, although this might be a topic to get into. I think the term survivor to mean someone who was in the camps and didn't die, it might be somewhat problematic, but that historically had been part of the backstory since the state of Claremont. But Magneto was canonically Jewish in the movies before he was in the comics. And even into kind of we're going to talk about the 1982 issue, even like a year before, there'd been a comic where it listed his ancestry as Nordic. And there is a kind of, so his being explicitly Jewish came much later on. I think it was like 2008. And that's paralleled by a lot of other comics characters as well. So like, I think it was the 1975 of Marvel had the Golem, where they kind of credited themselves, not within the comic, but in kind of the letters, as creating the first Jewish superhero. But a lot of Marvel characters haven't been kind of explicitly Jewish or explicitly Muslim until kind of much later on. So I think that's, obviously, we're here talking about Gabrielle Haller, but Magneto looms so large in this storyline. I think all of her stories, it's difficult to kind of talk around them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've been exploring on my show all year about how the themes and tones in the 70s were really changing in the way the stories were being told. So as we're interpreting the 60s comics, adding new data, etc., it gets more complex. I'll just do this in one mention because I think we can just get this part out of the way in one sentence. Captain America first came out of the iceberg in like the early 60s, which means he'd been in it for 18 years. But Marvel has this thing called the sliding time scale where he's only been out of it for 15 years. So now canonically, he was in the iceberg for like over 60 years. There's always a weird piece in characters that are dated in a particular way. Gabrielle Haller is one of those, just like Xavier, just like Magneto. We're going to see them in kind of the post-Korea World War II era. But now with the sliding time scale, we have to find a way to keep all of our characters alive for all that time. And that's just not a conversation we're prepared to have about her. Now, is Gabrielle Haller a character you had heard of before I suggested this conversation?
So there's a paper I've worked on kind of representation of Israel in Marvel Comics. And that's where I first encountered her. But I didn't know, certainly not as a kid watching the cartoon series, unless she was in there and I missed it. My first introduction was kind of doing some of the research.
Yeah, I've done this many times on my show to take a bit character and read them front to back and like look for the themes. Gabrielle Haller, we're going to spend at least a little while, of course, talking about her first appearance, but she basically has three kinds of stories in the comic books. Number one is Gabrielle as the concentration camp survivor / love interest of Charles Xavier, who he rescued and then romanced. It's complicated. Story type number two with her is as the mother of the character David Haller, or Legion, who is a tremendously powerful and interesting and problematic question mark character in Marvel Comics. The third one is Gabrielle as kind of the world leader. She becomes this kind of chain-smoking kind of boss woman with like some, I don't know if I'm misappropriating, but Golda Meir energy about her sometimes as she's kind of storming the stage and telling people how it is. And we get these kind of three versions of her interchanged depending on her portrayal. Am I missing any themes, do you think? Or does that kind of sum her up in one short paragraph?
No, I think that does a good job. Particularly her kind of her role as politician or as kind of sort of lawyer, like working in the United Nations, working for the Israeli embassy, those kind of roles. But yeah, I think you nailed it.
Claremont is Jewish himself. We're not going to talk because I can't interview him here for this conversation. But I think it was important for him to show this type of representation. So Gabrielle first shows up in the infamous issue Uncanny X-Men number 161. This issue is particularly famous because this shows us for the first time in 1982 the intense bond and relationship between Xavier and Magneto. And the division between their dreams or ideas for mutants has been around since X-Men number 1, but this is the storyline that really, really deeply explores that. Now, famously in Uncanny X-Men 200, which we'll get to in a little while, which is the trial of Magneto's story, there is almost a romantic affection between these two characters, as read by some, as Xavier goes off into space because he had a heart attack and leaves Magneto in charge of his team, you know, saying, hey, follow my dream. There's this image of him like cradling Xavier, like, and they're like longing into each other's eyes. Gabrielle Haller is an integral part of this initial story. What was it like for you, Philip, reading Uncanny X-Men number 161?
Like the things I was looking for was kind of how, so Claremont spent time in Israel during the 70s, and I was interested in seeing how his representation of Israel was kind of reflected through the comic. There were things that really sort of jumped out in terms of kind of Holocaust representation, the way that Xavier enters Gabrielle's mind and sort of sees this kind of nightmare scape, and the way that it's all dealt with through metaphor. You know, she became a statue of gold. All of her kind of tormentors are represented as ogres and things like that. And it then becomes turns into a kind of backdrop of a battle against Hydra. So I found it really interesting. I thought it was an interesting way of kind of unpacking in part or presenting a lens on the relationship between Xavier and Magneto and the different ways in which they use Jewish history as a way of kind of understanding the mutant experience in ways that were very explicit.
There's a lot of modern popular culture, media, adventure stories from Indiana Jones on down that are like obsessed with this idea of like discovering the hidden Nazi treasures or like the crazy Nazi science stuff that was started. There's a lot of stuff related to like the Thule Society and like all these different stories. They're all over Marvel Comics. They're all over popular fiction. This is one of those. The Nazis historically and famously robbed everyone of everything and stored it all for themselves. And there's a lot of popular stories about people trying to get back their family's artifacts that were stolen during World War II, paintings and resources. This is a story called Gold Rush. And the very simple premise here is Gabrielle Haller is a concentration camp survivor, and placed within her brain is the secret to where a secret stash of Nazi stolen gold is. And at the end of this story, Magneto takes the gold away and is going to go start his own mission with it. Oversimplifying it, we're going to cover all this stuff along the way, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about the theme of gold in this story as we begin.
This idea of, I mean, in some sense, it's the MacGuffin, the reason to bring the characters into conflict. One of the things that sort of struck me, there is a certain kind of, as you said before, there's this kind of simplicity of Nazis are unambiguously bad, like the kind of the uncomplicated bad guy. I think that there is a theme in scholarship on Holocaust and genocide studies of the way in which the kind of the unambiguous bad guy, where we don't need to think any further about their badness, it is kind of self-evident and absolute, is a way of dodging complicity, the way in which the Nazi killing project required the complicity and the acquiescence of more people, and the way in which if we present certain figures as kind of just, there's the bad guys, over here's the good guys, we are avoiding kind of conversations about the bystanders or the conversations about the people who indirectly benefited the murder of millions of people, the way in which, you know, the allies at a certain point knew what was happening and chose not to take action. You know, Churchill could have bombed the train lines and things like that. There is a sense in which this kind of, by introducing Hydra as the bad guys, there is a way in which this takes a potentially very complicated conversation and kind of simplifies it in to. Here's Nazis, they want gold.
It's interesting though, you know, comic books being what they are, we take real world events and we make them superhero stories, right? So it's Captain America versus Master Man. You get the evil geneticist and the evil wizard and the evil Nazi vampire. And like, those are all parts of the stories. Baron Strucker is probably, outside of, you know, Hitler and Red Skull, the most known Nazi character at Marvel. We're going to have some conversations about him on my show this summer because there is some content with him coming up. I've also done a lot of Magneto prequel stories on my show. We have not done this one. I'm waiting until we get to this space in Claremont's run before we cover this particular story. But in October 2023, I did a bunch of episodes in a row all about Magneto's backstory. He has been hunting Nazis in South America. He lost his daughter. His wife ran away from him. His entire family has been killed. He's changed his name. This is Magneto serving as a healer, working with victims who survived the camps as well. Is survive the right word to use here?
Yeah, it's not inappropriate to say survive. And, you know, people will talk about someone as a survivor. I think the danger is survivor has connotations that, you know, if someone who suffered through the kind of sustained trauma of the death camps and didn't die, to say that they survived might not necessarily kind of tell the whole story. I mean, many of those who went on to have lives after World War II were in many cases kind of haunted by trauma that, you know, it's not like they went back to, or were able to kind of go back to being the person they were before these experiences. Survivor is perhaps the best word we have, but it's, in many cases, the idea of survival isn't necessarily kind of an adequate fit for describing someone who...
Xavier has been traveling the world. This is in his Indiana Jones era. We've talked about it a little on my show. This is before he defeats Lucifer and becomes paralyzed in Tibet, which is a little farther on in his chronology. But he has recently come across the evil of the Shadow King in Cairo, which is where he first meets Storm. He now is here to kind of just explore. And he's in the city of Haifa to meet an old colleague named Daniel Shamron. Now, remember Daniel Shamron? He becomes Gabrielle Haller's husband a little bit later in our chronology. But this is an ally of Xavier's. They are in the real city of Haifa, which is one of the biggest cities in Israel, as I understand it. I'm not sure if there was any special reason why Claremont chose this city for the place where Magneto and Xavier are based in this story.
Not to my knowledge. I mean, they do a kind of a bit of a tour Israel later. So I think it's perhaps a kind of a convenient jumping off point. I don't know if it's specific to Claremont's own travels. That wasn't something I was able to, you know, it might be a city that he has kind of particular memories of. And so that's why we chose.
Yeah, yeah. In it, we are meeting Gabrielle Haller for the first time. She is in a catatonic state. She's wearing a green house dress. She just kind of stares off into nothing. They can't break through to her. And Daniel, in a speech to Xavier, explains, most of our volunteers work in camps, Charles. They bring a degree of empathy to their work that the rest of us can't match. But occasionally there comes a case that stymies our best efforts. This is Gabrielle Haller. Her experiences in Dachau so traumatized her that she withdrew into catatonic schizophrenia, a total retreat from reality. She was like this when she arrived here. She hasn't improved yet. We've tried every means humanly possible to bring her out of her trance, save those of involving physical pain. She suffered enough of that already. I turn to you as a last resort, Charles. They've heard about Charles's ability to connect with people on a deep level because he's a telepath. They don't know that part. Charles was also in the Korean War, where he experienced the deaths of a lot of soldiers. He's an orphan. He's got his own fair share of trauma. The idea of him as a healer, able to kind of build those bridges, is fine as long as it's morally followed, but we're going to talk about the complexities of that as well. Xavier enters her mind, and we have this kind of visual of astral scapes as they exist within people's minds. This is a comic book trope of like telepathy working. We see there's a vast wall protecting Gabrielle inside her mind. Psychic monsters are there to fight him off. He blasts away these defenses while thinking, I wonder though if she has found peace within herself. Have I the right to force her to confront her past, her present? Yes, life is the greatest of gifts, the ultimate wonder. It should neither be taken nor wasted. Gabrielle must be allowed her full chance to live, to grow, to be all that she can possibly be. And then he's getting ready to delve into this woman's very private trauma without her consent, but she clearly is also a woman who needs a lot of help. She's stuck in this state. What are your thoughts on these early scenes?
I think there is a tendency in these comics to kind of bandy about psychological terms without necessarily there being a relationship to kind of real life mental conditions. What I think they do kind of happen upon here is that some people who've worked with survivors have been very generous in lending their time to them. And a theme that I've encountered quite a lot is the idea that typically if you're working with someone who's traumatized, having them talk through and narrate and kind of give form to their experiences can be therapeutic. But what I heard from a lot lot of people was for people who survived the camps, saying, let's talk about what you went through isn't necessarily healing or helpful and can actually be kind of very counterproductive. The sort of sustained trauma of someone who went through the camps is often such that really what they benefit from is social support, kind of being around family, rather than trying to kind of go back and reconstruct in a way that someone might be affected for other forms of trauma. And of course, this becomes a kind of a major theme and point of contention in the relationship between Gabrielle and Xavier. Muses about the kind of the ethics of him getting her to relive some of this trauma. Now, obviously, in this case, you know, in this kind of fictional world, it brings her out of it and is helpful. It's an interesting intersection with, I think, if you were to take kind of real life equivalent person, I don't know if talking things through would necessarily be a form of therapy that would actually be beneficial.
I am not a telepath. This is a fictional story. I am a trauma therapist, though. This is what I do for a living.
Oh, of course, yes.
There are certain types of traumas that have to be navigated with extreme sensitivity. When we are working with veterans who have witnessed casualties or who have been a part of taking the life of another person, when we're working with a woman who's been sexually assaulted, when we're working with someone who has seen death up close, or particularly if your family is killed, and oh my goodness, when you are a genocide survivor, that amplifies all of that to about 100, right? Because Gabrielle's been through all of these things. We're not going to spend a lot of time on the ethics of Xavier, but I do think it's an important piece of the complexity of this character, particularly when she reflects on things later. So Xavier's back in her brain. He sees images of demonic Nazis, and he starts to get glimpses into her past. At age 10, he says, through her young, innocent eyes, he relives the war. He/she stands packed so tightly in a cattle car that the dead cannot fall, but remain on their feet, supported by those around them till the cars are unloaded. Her grandmother dies that way, by Gabby's side. The lucky ones are gassed, their bodies cremated, but Gabby is beautiful. The guards like her. So she survives, young in years, ancient in spirit. Oh, that part breaks my heart. Innocent no longer, because the implication here is that she was sexually assaulted multiple times. Was she wicked, evil? The child wonders that she should be punished so. She thinks of suicide, but lacks the courage. She prays the guards will tire of her and send her to the gas chamber, but they never do. Instead, in the last days of the war, she is dragged before the commandant, who points a magic wand at her, chants an obscene spell, and transforms her into solid gold. And while he's there, Gabby starts to wake up from her coma, starts crying for her parents. Xavier holds her as she sobs. That's it, Gabby. Have a good cry. That's a darling. You're all right now. You're among friends. You're safe. Claremont can do a lot in one fucking page.
In Holocaust and Genocide, so there is a kind of recurring theme of what has been called the kind of the Americanization of the Holocaust. I don't think that it's unique to American culture, this kind of process.
As a culture in America and other places, we have formed a way of talking about these topics that feels culturally acceptable, and we make it dark and we push a little, but we don't go to the really dark places often because it's too uncomfortable. I do think there is an Americanization process with all that.
Often when we read the testimony of survivors kind of firsthand, Primo Levi says, when we use language to talk about the Holocaust, we're using the language that of outside of the camps. He says we would need a different language to talk about the experiences of people who went through that. And there's this idea that we have to sort of reflexively create narratives. And when we create narratives, we are looking for happy endings. We are looking to place things within a three-act structure. And a recurring theme in survivor testimony and scholarship is the idea that the Holocaust is not suitable to that kind of narrativization or of moral finding. Industry that was designed to kill people in the most efficient way possible, that used all the trappings of modernization and laws and timetables and kind of industry to murder people, did so for many years. It's very difficult for us to imagine kind of 6 million of anything. And so the idea then that we can kind of take that and have anything to say about it other than just being horrified is I think perhaps a misunderstanding of the kind of the scale and the implications of it. So this is not unique to this, but I think whenever we encounter the use of the Holocaust in popular culture, for it then to kind of be something that we then arrive at some kind of a moral or some kind of an outcome or some kind of something arising from the ashes of this tragedy, I think we should be very suspicious of that. Conversely, Lydia Coppola, writing about representation of the Holocaust in children's literature, she argues, well, you know, we are always going to get it wrong. We cannot represent the Holocaust in a way that's ever kind of accepting of it, it or able to contain its moral and philosophical dimensions. If we then just kind of just give up, then that doesn't work either. I mean, it's something not to talk about.
Yeah.
And so her argument is, in children's literature, arguably superhero comics, whether or not that falls under children's literature or not, I think it depends on readership and many other factors. Her argument would be, we need to provide parts of the story so that the reader can then kind of go and learn more, that this can be a kind of a jumping off point. So I don't think Claremont here possibly could kind of bear the full responsibility of trying to represent the Holocaust, but what he can do is give us enough so that a readership might then kind of be led from there to read Survivor Testimony or to, you know, watch Landsman Shoah or move on to something that kind of deals with this in a less packaged form.
Absolutely. And I would classify this as a kid's book in that it's dense, but parents will let their kids read it. And what we have Claremont doing multiple times, and I'm really excited to get to the Claremont books on my show next year. The entire backstory for Magneto is one page. Storm losing her parents in the plane crash in Cairo, one page. Cyclops' father being pulled up into space after his mom was killed before his eyes, one page. So Claremont's adding a level of depth here. He could give us 20 pages of the atrocities that Gabrielle suffered, but that's not fun. We don't want to read that in a comic book where we're looking for superheroes punching each other. But to add that level of depth, to give us enough to connect to see that this woman is an extreme survivor. I don't know if Claremont based this off of a real story he knew, but it's a shocking amount of backstory because he could have introduced Gabrielle without any of that. Xavier goes in her mind and wakes her up and that's it. And we don't have any clue about the rest, but he gave us a lot. In fact, we know a lot about Magneto in the camps many years later, but at this point in the comics, we know way more about Gabrielle and her backstory than we do Magneto, which is a really interesting thing.
No, I was going to say, and this might be where you're going, but I think it's also kind of relevance. You know, the setting is not random here. This is also kind of part of the Holocaust as the kind of Israeli national narrative that obviously is something that Claremont was kind of very much attuned to and uses this comic to kind of open the debate on.
We have not mentioned yet the political sensitivity of some of these conversations about what's happening in our world in 2024, but that is implied and we will perhaps get there later. So weeks go by. Gabrielle spends a lot of time with Xavier and Magneto, and these are her two key relationships in the books moving forward. She has connections to Legion, to Moira McTaggart, a few other characters, but Xavier as the guy who rescued her, the white American who rescued her, and Magneto as the man who is her fellow survivor, who's going off to protect another subdivided group of people, of whom her son is one. So she has kind of a reverential, complex relationship with Magneto. You get the vibe very quickly with this character that she kind of believes in Magneto's stances and what he's capable of, where there's always the question of, what did Xavier rescuing me mean? And like, how did that affect me? She has a patience for Magneto and an enduring kind of empathy for him in a way that she seems to lack for Charles. That's an early conversation that we'll analyze a few more times. But do you have any thoughts on Gabrielle's connection to these characters, particularly Magnus?
I think maybe one of the ways that this is kind of positioned is Xavier's the kind of the reader surrogate who's kind of discovering a place which for Gabrielle and Magneto, they already have a pre-existing relationship with this place. And so there is a certain kind of Xavier as Taurus as well, kind of entering into this relationship. I wonder perhaps what Claremont is doing here is kind of suggesting an affinity between Gabrielle and Magneto because of a shared trauma.
So the allegory here is there is a camp in Israel trying to help a catatonic woman. They summon a doctor from America who helps her, but then ends up fathering a child with her. that's the direction we're going here. So we see kind of some weeks go by. Gabrielle is like best friends with Magneto and Xavier. They're skipping all over the place. It talks about how she's from Holland and now she's settling into her new life with remarkable ease, says Xavier. They explore Galilee and Jerusalem and the Negev Desert. Xavier and Magnus start having their conversations about mutant causes and where things differ. And we have a lot of flashbacks to this time between the two of them in multiple forms of media. There's a date now between Xavier and Gabby. She's in a pink dress and Gabby makes a pass at him, but he's kind of distracted and then realizes, oh, she's in love with me. First place his brain goes, this man's a narcissist at all costs. Knowing he shouldn't, he leans in to kiss her. She says, I owe you everything, dear Charles, but I have no means of repaying you save this. And I think I might be comfortable with this relationship except for that line of dialogue, because this makes me feel like this character's reenacting her trauma. She had to like stay alive by performing. We're not going to go there in a long way, but there's a difference between I like something and I'm reenacting trauma when it comes to people who have, we're just going to ... that. If anyone has a question, shoot me a message. But I think it's a part of the conversation as well that is very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I defer to you somewhat in this in terms of the kind of the doctor patient relationship.
It's the number one like ethical violation.
Yeah,
and one thing you don't do.
Yeah, it is something like in later comics that he does kind of reflect on and worry about. I don't know if in this issue there is that level of introspection, and I don't know if there's necessarily expectation as readers that we are to see this as a kind of moral quandary. I think one of the ways that perhaps problematic way in which this is presented is he's a tourist. He's kind of so enamored with the place, you know, his surroundings and everything he's seeing. And here is Gabby and this way in which they kind of stumble into one of his arms.
There's an element of kind of like Captain Kirk. Every time he lands on a foreign planet, there's a beautiful alien, you know? There's almost like kind of that American soldier story of wherever I go, I find a girl that's interested in me. Mm. And that also makes it uncomfortable. We're not going to spend a lot of time there. The thing I will say therapeutically, I do a lot of work with people and I'm a very open therapist. So I'm known in like the kinky sex or polyamory communities as a safe place to come and talk about your lifestyle. Although I focus more on trauma and LGBTQ work. But I do think there's a thing, if you were sexually abused as a kid and you are turned on as an adult by dom sub dynamics, there's no problem with that. So long as you know it's a sexual kink that you're enjoying and not you're reenacting your trauma for subliminal or subconscious reasons. Oversimplifying, and it's a much more complex issue, but I do think that's part of Gabby's thought pattern here. When she says, I have no other way to repay you, that's very uncomfortable, but that's more about Claremont than it is about this fictional character. So I'm going to cover this next part relatively quickly, and then let's talk about the overall plot line. We see some Hydra agents show up in green armor. Charles is grazed by a bullet. They have been watching Gabrielle for years, and now they kidnap her now that she's awake, because she has the location of this like secret gold stash buried in her brain, and they knew it. The soldiers use words like Jewish and she-wolf, and they threaten violence against her. Magneto kills some of the agents, but she is still kidnapped. We go to Baron Strucker, who's keeping her in chains. He calls her a mongrel. He calls her weak. He forces her to admit where a cave of gold stolen by the Nazis has been kept. And it turns out half of Hitler's stolen gold stash is in this place. They want to use it to start a Fourth Reich. And an example of Strucker's words here, where better to hide the gold than Black Africa among savages? And who better to turn into a living map to this vault than a Jewish child? Very, very uncomfortable. I know they're making a villain speak these words, but I think in modern comics, even when we are using Hydra or Nazi characters, because this still happens, we still have Captain America comics, I think they're much more sensitive with the language these days. Putting these types of words on the page by a group of white creators is uncomfortable slash problematic, and they kind of delve into stereotypes, even though they're trying to show you how awful it is. So Xavier and Magneto quickly come to the rescue. They defeat the Nazis. Gabrielle's back in the coma, but this time Xavier knows he can't help her. She has to want to live, to pull out of it herself, which is maybe where we should have started. And at the end, Magneto flies away with the gold. Xavier asks how Gabby feels when she wakes up, and she says, strange, I remember everything, yet it feels like some fantastic dream. I was huddled behind a wall in my mind, alone, terrified. I knew nothing could hurt me there. I'd be safe, protected forever. Then I heard your voice. I was no longer alone. If I left my hiding place, I'd risk being hurt, but I knew that if I stayed, I'd be condemning myself once more to a living death. I couldn't bear that. Scared of one choice, more scared of the other, I followed your call. Oh, Charles, it's so wonderful to be alive.
Claremont is not kind of endorsing the type of language that these characters use. I mean, it reminded me of Mouse is one of the texts that I teach in class. One thing I've learned is for the comfort of the students, I will read the snippets of dialogue that are spoken by German characters, because I find even if the language is fairly innocuous, students are often hesitant to read those characters, and so I'll do it for them. And then there are certain things they say where, as we are approaching the panel, I'll just say, hey, there's some language coming up, just go past it, because even though we know that these words are coming from the character that we are not expected to, you know, their viewpoint is not being endorsed, I think there is still a certain kind of discomfort.
But we did in the 80s a lot. Claremont famously wrote a story where Kitty Pryde uses the N-word to try to reason with a person of color about how she understands what it's like to be like them. It's very uncomfortable. And, you know, evil characters in particular. We're going to cover a lot of content on my show this summer when we're talking about the portrayal of women of color in the comics in the 70s. I think sometimes the intentions are good, but it grows uncomfortable.
Obviously, this is kind of used as a dialogue that Xavier and Magneto have in various different forms about the kind of what is appropriate for mutants to do to kind of defend themselves. I don't think that means that necessarily Claremont is inviting us to agree with Magneto's conclusions, but this is used as a kind of a stage for that dialogue to kind of to play out, as it will many, many times across many, many comics. And this, of course, also, you know, this rhetoric is what later gives rise to, you know, House of X and the being a mutant nation, where when Magneto meets with various different representatives of different countries, he does so with Jerusalem as a backdrop, and he kind of mentions that this is kind of appropriate for talking about there being a mutant nation.
You know, I actually agree with you completely, and it's hard because it was a different time, right? This is 42 years ago, if I'm doing my math right, when this comic came out, so it's a lot different. Magneto's an interesting character to try to capture, because when you're writing Magneto, and we've seen Al Ewing do some really beautiful work with him in the last few years. If you have not, by the way, Philip, read the Resurrection of Magneto series, issue 2 in particular really delves into his psychology. There's also a recent limited series by J.M. DeMatteis just called Magneto that is a really good character study of him. Because you have to write him with the right amount of trauma. You know, he's going to make statements on the page, I lost my family, I'll never lose my people, I know what it's like to survive this. But he becomes, in effect, one of the most hated people in the Marvel Universe, a mass murderer, and in effect, a version of Hitler to some people who see him doing atrocities against the people who are not his. So there's a line between protecting my people and hurting other people because they're not my people. And Magneto is sometimes on both sides of that line. So we're going to jump to New Mutants number one. When Claremont creates a woman character, he always wants to make them very powerful and very competent. And that's one of my favorite things about his writing. This is where Storm and Rogue and all of these incredible characters like Psylocke get to shine really brightly. Kitty Pryde. He also attaches to a lot of side characters, Valerie Cooper and Alice Dane and Lee Forrester. Gabrielle Haller is one of those. He brings her up once in a while. We see her in New Mutants number one. It's 1983. She's older now because it's not, you know, the flashback to the past. And she is the Israeli ambassador to London. She has black hair. She's still thin. She is chain smoking from here forward in nearly all of her appearances. There is a lit cigarette forever in her hand. So as the Israeli ambassador to London, she visits Dr. Moira MacTaggert and Ilyana Rasputin, and she's on Muir Island, and she confides in Moira. Your reputation in the field of mutant genetics is considerable, Moira. So is my need. I have a son, not much older than you, Ilyana, an autistic child. His autism is merely a symptom of something far more serious. The boy is a mutant. I believe his abilities are primarily psionic, telepathy, possibly telekinesis. I've tried every means to help him without success. I turn to you as a last resort. Moira says, and I'm not doing accents here, folks. She says, I'm flattered, but my work is theoretical in nature, not practical. You need Charles Xavier. And Gabrielle says, I want Charles kept out of this. When Moira asks why, she says, I have my reasons. And then when Moira presses her again, she says, very well, since you insist, Charles Xavier is the boy's father. And we don't hear any more of this for like 2 full years in the comic book.
It felt jarring going from the first comic. I think in part, I mean, maybe one of the ways to kind of rationalize it is what we get in the first comic is Xavier's memory of their relationship. And then maybe this is suggesting he's not an entirely reliable narrator, or that his memories miss out certain things, because
he likes to make himself the hero of every story. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, and again, this kind of this Americanization of these narrative kind of the requirement for there to be a hero. And so I wonder if, rather than this being a kind of a rewriting of the previous narrative, that we're now getting this narrative from a different perspective. Maybe Gabrielle's memories of their relationship are not the same as Xavier's. One doesn't have the impression at the end of the first comic we talked about that their relationship kind of ended sourly, or that she'd have a reason to not want to interact with them again, or that there being perhaps a kind of a complexity to the relationships here that we didn't see earlier. Because it felt to me as though if I did not know that this was kind of her next appearance, I would think that there would be something in the middle to give more kind of reasons behind this rip.
Yeah, Claremont had a lot of room to build stories over a long period of time. My listeners are very well familiar with my thoughts on the psychology of Charles Xavier, so I'm not going to tangent there today, but there's certainly a lot going on with this guy too. So they're back in New Mutants number 26. This is 1985. Bill Sienkiewicz is on art. I love Bill Sienkiewicz art. It's so untraditional for comic books. Gabrielle and her son David have moved to Muir Isle. Gabrielle's smoking, and Xavier has landed on the island, and this is their first first reunion. I will not read every line of dialogue, I promise, but this interchange is important. Gabby? Gabrielle Haller? It's been so long, you're as lovely as ever. She smiles, and you've become a silver-tongued devil. It's good to see you. She hugs him and says, I could wish for pleasanter circumstances. My son David is Moira's patient, the reason for your summons. Moira jumps in. He's autistic. He has been since he was 10. He's schizophrenic withdrawal from reality, so complete that no one, not me, not any other physician Gabby's turned to over the years, have been able to reach him. Xavier says, why did you wait so long to call me, Gabby? I could have helped the boy as I did you. Ugh, rough. Not I sympathize, but immediately, like, why am I not the most important person in the room? She goes, there were personal considerations. I didn't want you involved. Now I've no choice but to help my son, Charles. You're my last hope. And he says, I should have been your first. And he thinks, like, is she embarrassed because we, like, had sex that one time? Maybe I should probe her mind to find out her secrets. But no, I don't want to pry into her thoughts.
He seems to be more introspective here than we encountered him before. And there is more kind of more explicit reference to the fact that they were sexually involved. What we got last time was her sort of going, I don't want anything to do with him. This time around, she describes him as silver tongued. There's some persiflage going on here. There's flirting in a way that seems a little confusing, because there's at the same time Xavier's kind of examining his own emotions and does kind of reflect on the ethics of getting her to kind of relive her past. I was curious for you, do you kind of, as someone who's a professional working in this area, do you sort of wince a little bit the way that, like, the term schizophrenic gets thrown around?
Except it was of the time, right? They're tossing schizophrenic and, like, catatonic around, and that's not quite what's going on. It's an interesting thing when you see mental health. You know, every villain in the Batman Rogue Gallery has a different mental health issue, right? Like, it's some sort of disorder personified. It's interesting when you turn that into, like, a mutant power. There's an allegory about most mutants, about how, like, their powers influence their personalities. Legion is a really interesting character because it's almost as though they're turning schizophrenia into the scariest superpower. It feels like an 80s horror movie, that there's, like, this stammering character in a mental hospital who every time he shifts, it's, you know, Danny's not here anymore. Like, shifting from one character to another, he's the little girl crying in the bed. Now he's the axe murderer trying to break through the wall. There's very much that vibe with this character. On a more personal level, for Gabrielle to have this child that she realizes is different and she genuinely needs help, for her to have to stretch so far as to call the man who hurt her, the man she's been avoiding, this is a big deal for her character and shows you she's really trying to put her child first. Like, she's at her wit's end. Let me read this next interchange between them. She approaches Xavier a little bit later. She starts massaging his shoulders. Your shoulders are hard as steel. Not for long. That feels marvelous. You've done well with your life, he says. Now, you could read this as two exes having a conversation years later. It's hard to believe that Xavier does not mentally influence people into, like, telling him you're so great all the time. There's a thing that happens with this character that's uncomfortable. He says, you've done well with your life. She says, ambassador today, maybe foreign minister tomorrow. After that, who knows? Prime minister of Israel? I like the sound of that. He says, I too. You never married. She says, I only met two men worth the commitment. One died. The other always had other commitments. So remember that comment about one died. It was criminal of me to take advantage of you. You were my patient, Gabby. My power gave me access to every corner of your being. Oof, that phrasing is so creepy. There's no greater trust, especially since it was not freely given. I forced myself into your mind and I abused it. And now I think he's telepathically, like, having her reassure him of his own guilt. She says, nonsense. We both found a comfort we desperately needed in each other's arms. However guilty you may feel, Charles, I have no regrets. A telepath can play God. You've no idea how tempting that is. I can change thoughts, twist memories, destroy a personality, erase it utterly, and recreate it any way I choose. I tell myself I use this ability solely to do good, only to remember that my arch rival Magneto uses those same words to justify his actions. When I first understood what you did and could do, I became terrified of you. I asked myself if my thoughts, my feelings, were my own or phantoms you'd placed there. That's one reason why I never wrote you after you returned to America. I told myself it was wrong to believe so, that you were an honorable man, that you'd never do such things. but the doubts remained. I couldn't help myself. I don't know that answer, Charles, and I don't care. I'm fighting for the life of my child. Face down the devil himself if I have to. He has powers like yours, and he's using them to hurt people. Moira told me of her own mad mutant son, Proteus, and how the X-Men and she were forced to slay him. I don't want that fate for David. If there's a way, Gabby, if there's any hope at all, I'll find it. Now tell me about the trauma that made him autistic. It's not really how autism works.
You know, what he's saying here is, the thing that makes me different from everyone else is that I am supremely powerful. This is a kind of recurring thing that kind of complicates these metaphors, that it's also a fantasy of kind of being more powerful than everyone around you. All of which kind of complicates this idea of the kind of the it as minority experience. And the way that he's kind of torturing himself by going, like, believe me, I'm so powerful. Really, really, really powerful. It's awful.
We're going to talk about the way big continuity blocker. In House of X, Powers of X, there is an illusion that Xavier, Moira, and Charles all were conspiring in the early days of their friendship to secure a mutant future because Moira has lived multiple lives before and chose to share that with these men. That's the retroactive continuity. The three of them then had a pact to father or mother a child that would have significant mutant potential in the future, that would be their heirs. Magneto fathers Polaris through Susanna Dane. Moira marries Joe McTaggart and has Proteus, and Xavier sleeps with Gabrielle Haller and has Legion. And the discomfort in that makes it so much worse because that means he set out to do this for the needs of the future so that she could have his child. We don't have to spend time there, but I'm just going to toss that out. It's never been reconciled in the comics.
and I read this as, because this is about kind of securing mutants' safety, it's tempting to read it as kind of allegory for nuclear armament, right? This idea of kind of the deliberate cultivation of kind of super mutants who give the people of Krakoa a threat so that they can dangle over potential enemies. This is nuclear armament, right? Like this is the allegory that's being suggested for this.
We get a peek into Gabrielle's thoughts in a little while where she is not telling Xavier that he's the child's father. She wants this a secret. And we get a thought like where she says, you know, you invaded me. You saw every part of me. This is the one thing that I am keeping to myself, which is very tender. But now we soon get the backstory. It turns out she learned she was pregnant after Xavier left. She married Daniel Shamron, wants to keep the child. The child is relatively happy and normal until there is an anti-Israeli terrorist attack from a man named Jamal Karami. During this moment where civilians are killed and Daniel Shamron ends up dying, protecting David, David's powers activate and this terrorist's mind enters Legion's body and is now causing problems there. We're not going to spend a lot of time on that story. We'll focus more on Legion another time. Oh, it is important to note the terrorist attack was in Paris. That's also important to note.
So he's kind of pointing to kind of historical allegories. And I think the idea of kind of Gabrielle as being kind of inherently vulnerable because of her position is, I think that would make sense to kind of readers over time and perhaps readers now as well. The idea of, there is also, as you say, this mechanism of, we can't just have a kind of a happy couple because there's no story there. That is kind of, there needs to be some kind of a tragic triggering event for them.
Yeah, we love some juicy drama.
Yeah.
So the other piece of this Karami character who's now dwelling in Legion's mind, they keep calling him the Arab. He was a terrorist. Now we're learning they think he's fighting David, but David's mind has fractured into many personalities. And it turns out this Arab character in his brain is trying to help the personalities heal. And they all work together to heal David's mind in the end. And the Arab-Israeli allegory here is not very thinly veiled. Do you have thoughts on the Arab?
Yeah, and not really drawn with a kind of high degree of complexity either. I sort of winced at, I'm just like, the name of the character. And I think this is kind of an attempt to connect with kind of contemporary politics, but often at a distance. It's a way of kind of referencing world events, but without necessarily kind of trying to then actually provide a kind of a comment. It struck me as what they're going for here is there is a kind of a verisimilitude to world events, but without it actually being kind of explicit enough to be saying anything. By watching action movies, you can kind of tell which country America kind of has beef with at any given moment by just like, what accent do the bad guys have? Like, is it Russian? Is it, you know, Middle Eastern? And it felt quite similar to me, where it's kind of not a direct comment on world events, but just kind of an amorphous sense of like, here's today's bad guy.
So in the end of the story, Legion's mind is still broken into pieces. I don't know if you've seen the show Legion that was out a few years ago. It's phenomenal. I'd highly recommend it. It's based on Cy Spurrier's Legion series or X-Men Legacy series. It's incredible. Legion has the power to manifest different superpowers, basically anything you can think of, but they have a different personality in his brain attached to them. So there's a whole bunch of stories about this guy over the years. He's in the Krakoan era, written by Cy Spurrier brilliantly. Very sympathetic version of this character. We cannot fault Xavier for not knowing about David prior to this moment, but Xavier chooses not to be involved in the child's life basically after this moment. And that's where we get really concerned. And there's a lot of stories about David as the son of Charles, even well into the Krakoan era. It's been like part of the Fall of the House of X stories that are happening right now. But there's a moment where Xavier's explaining this fractured brain, and he basically like alludes, like he came from trauma, so now he's living trauma. And Gabrielle says, my fault then, my failures, my mistakes. And he goes, oh, mine too. There's a very odd kind of way this, and she begs him to help Legion as much as he can, but they kind of just keep this kid sedated and hope that it's going to go away, which is basically what Moira did with Proteus too. These are not good parents, folks.
There's a really good essay called kind of Memory Shot Through the Holes about growing up with parents who, Holocaust survivors, who kind of, the way in which a kind of traumatized worldview can be kind of transmitted, and also totally on an epigenetic level, the way that trauma can kind of future generations. So I think this, it does invite a dialogue on something that kind of people have, second generation survivors have kind of commented on, this sense of being brought up by someone whose sense of the world is so kind of profoundly shaped by their trauma. When they're trying to kind of teach you about the world, that trauma kind of bleeds through. And, you know, this is, anyone who's read Mouse, this is a kind of recurring theme in the relationship between Artie and Vladek, of the way that Artie feels that he kind of, there's one point where he says when he was growing up, he had a fantasy of kind of having been through the camps with his parents, so that way he wouldn't have this feeling that nothing that happens in his life is kind of any consequence compared to what they went through. And also this kind of sibling rivalry he feels with his brother who died before he was born, who died during the Holocaust. So this idea of inherited trauma does have a kind of something of a basis, and I'm sure, you know, your work probably comes up.
Yeah,
so
generational trauma is certainly one that's used, absolutely. Gabrielle is part of the huge Trial of Magneto story that comes back in Uncanny X-Men 200. Now, this is also a storyline used in the new X-Men 97 cartoon. So you're going to be interested to watch this because you just read these comics. Gabrielle has been appointed the defense counsel, basically, for Magneto, who's being put on trial. He's submitted himself to a national trial. It's very Nuremberg, if you are familiar with those stories from history. There has been a United Nations kind of appointed group of jurors from different countries. There's a really awful guy named Jaspers. That's a character Excalibur fans will recognize, but we're not going to go there today. Arguing against Magneto, Gabrielle is arguing for. And her initial argument is basically, we have to look at the motivations of someone who is acting, and that has to be part of the conversation. Oversimplifying. She also later gets it, and I love that Claremont does this. There's a story in Defender 16 where Magneto gets changed into a baby, and then he's later reverted to adulthood. So Gabrielle goes, anything he did before he was changed to a baby should be considered someone else. We should only do the stuff after. And they're like, yes, that makes a lot of sense. And so she gets him acquitted for everything up to Defenders number 16, which is where we talk about it in the Trial of Magneto on my show. There is a moment a little bit later where Gabrielle is being yelled at by the crowd. They're calling her a slut, a mutie lover, shame on you, woman, foreigner. Kitty Pryde's kind of worked up and upset about all of this. She's young and she's Jewish and she's confused. Gabrielle says to her, a mob isn't people, Kitty. It's perhaps the wildest of animals. And later she says, it's easy to run away or give up as my parents did. They were lucky. They died in Bergen-Belsen. For them, the pain ended quickly. They've no memories to haunt them, no more fears. But we who survived have a duty to make certain the Holocaust never happens again to anyone. We must fight, Kitty. We may be defeated, but we must never surrender.
There is a tendency to, on the one hand, there's this kind of the treating the people who were killed in the death camps as kind of somehow kind of saintly. And then also the idea that there was some quality that some people in the camps didn't die and other people did. And this is a very kind of recurring thing. You know, you might look at like Frankel makes an argument that, you know, people kind of somehow are able to kind of keep themselves alive when other people didn't. That's a very dangerous narrative. Really, no one had the choice to live. There were people who kind of did sort of take actions that would take their own life. You know, Frankel would talk about if you saw someone smoking their own cigarettes, you knew that they were preparing to manufacture a situation where they would be shot. But no one, it's not to suggest that the right combination of action actions could have resulted in someone surviving, I think is too simplistic and also insulting to the people who died.
Well, and the two things I'll say there, number one, everybody's trauma is their own. If this is a way a person felt about their trauma and they were expressing it, I would not judge them. But right. to have a white male writing that into a character's mouth feels a little bit different. But I do like the complexity in the character. I'm okay with characters being messy. The second thing, a lot of people historically who survived the camps were not well treated by people. What did you have to do in order to survive? Right. Sometimes they were seen as miracles, other times as pariahs. There's a lot packed into these stories.
For a long time, people just didn't really talk about it. It wasn't really kind of until the 60s in the Eichmann trial where there was any kind of real sort of public discourse around it. As you say, you know, there isn't one experience of trauma, but there was a kind of a general sense of people not wanting to tell their stories, not wanting to kind of look back. I would imagine, you know, perhaps inappropriately, but that sense of survivor guilt. Why did I survive and others didn't? Or, you know, why did others die and I didn't? But there's a line, and I forget who it was, and they say the best of us did not survive. I think there's, I'm very uncomfortable with kind of such sentiments. And I think in part it's about the kind of sentimentalizing. I think it should be enough that human beings were killed without us then needing to kind of ascribe qualities to the human beings who were killed to kind of make them extra special human beings or kind of, you know, morally superior to others. It's like, you know, they were human beings, and that you know, we don't need an extra layer of that to make this more tragic.
Now, we are skipping over all the Legion stories that don't directly involve Gabrielle. We're keeping this focused on her, but Legion's got some stuff going on around this time, including murdering Destiny. This trial goes on for a little while, and basically where things end up is the children of Baron Strucker, who also has mutant kids. This is Andreas and Andrea Strucker, who are like the twins that grab hands and then like murder people that they think of as less than them. They're the Nazi incest children, twincest children of Baron Strucker. There's a whole big superhero thing. Basically, what ends up happening in the end is the United Nations determines that Magneto is out of their jurisdiction and he's acquitted. You know, the charges are dropped, basically. The story is revisited again in 1987 in the X-Men versus Avengers series, and Gabrielle represents Magneto again. This time, Magneto ends up submitting to the court's decision, but they also, in the end of this story, determine that he is beyond their jurisdiction.
Martin Lund's reading of this, so it's kind of brushing up on some of the literature on Magneto, that this is in part the kind of condemnation of the way that the United Nations have kind of responded to Israel during this period, Zionism equals racism position, and that this was a kind of a sort of a commentary on that. Again, my feeling is that I don't think superhero comics necessarily try to be that direct. I find the reading a little bit complicated, although a point that there was an argument obviously voiced by a character that we're not expected to empathize with. So throughout this, there's this kind of people using the Holocaust as a way to talk about the mutant experience. And so, you know, Gabrielle saying, we have to make sure that no such thing happens again. We have another character who makes an argument where he says, you know, I've seen a mutant death camps. And he kind of presents an argument that an analogy here wouldn't be appropriate. Extrapolating from the Holocaust to kind of this imaginary experience of mutants, it raises more problems through the analogy than it necessarily kind of is helpful. So this is not a character with whom we're expected to empathize. The sentiment of this must never happen again has not stopped genocides from happening. The Art Spiegelman had an exhibition called Never Again and Again and Again and Again, and you know, makes the point that Cambodia, Rwanda, you know, this sentiment doesn't necessarily kind of, the idea that we must learn lessons from history, if we're really committed to the idea of never again, humanity have kind of failed in that commitment. I read it in part, on the one hand, the kind of affirmation of this sentiment of if we are to take a lesson from genocide, then it should be, you know, this cannot happen again. But also the argument that drawing comparisons is between kind of historical events is kind of ethically fraught.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic insights, man. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. This is making my brain fire on all cylinders. I'm going to jump to X-Men Unlimited number 2. We'll cover this one quickly. It's one of my favorite Magneto stories. It's a Nicieza story. We've literally read this script out loud on my show, so go look that up if you like. Gabrielle shows up lecturing at Empire State University. She's a doctor now. She's described as the former ambassador to Great Britain from Israel. She's lecturing in a class on practical applications of international law on demagogues of the 20th century. She's smoking all through her lecture. I'm only going to read one point of her lecture where she says, "For the most part, I can separate Magnus the Man from Magneto, the mutant crusader. And please note my choice of words, for I have valid reasons to label Magneto crusader, not dictator. Firstly, he has no country to call his own. Secondly, he's fought for a specific cause, cause, not for personal power. Which begs the question then, before he died in a battle above Earth, was Magneto a demagogue or an ideologue? Was he a tyrannical madman, placing himself above the rights of humanity, or the righteous zealot fighting for a noble cause, equality for mutants? Can any one of us truly answer such a question? There's a guy named Adrian Iceskull who's trying to hunt Magneto down, and he meets with Gabrielle a bunch of times, and she monitors his mission to assassinate Magneto. But the other exchange in this book that I love so much, Gabrielle is in Mossad, like the government building. She's talking to Moira McTaggart on a screen. Two lines, they're just reading Charles, which is so funny. Moira says, "Women who've loved that man are few and far between. We share that experience together." In essence, we both fuck Professor X, so we understand each other. And Gabrielle replies, "I thought that lonely dark ocean of loss was mine alone to dive into." Which is phenomenal. I'm also going to cover this next section a little bit quickly. In X-Factor 108-109, it's 1994, we see Gabrielle watching over Legion, who is in a coma. And he recently killed Destiny in the Muir Island saga. And now Mystique is sneaking in to try to get him back. And he has a very rational moment where he's himself for just a minute in this story. He's awake, he's alert, he's calling her mother. "I'm going to make everything okay." And remember, this is like a 12-year-old child, but he's aged his body up to adulthood. And then he just flies off. He's going to do something. And we'll talk about what that is in just a moment. But she has a moment where he called me mother. Like, when you are a person who's caretaking somebody and they have that moment of lucidity, it's so wonderful, even though things get really bad really quickly.
The idea of kind of the most compelling villains are the ones where we understand their motivation. We don't necessarily agree with the course of action they've taken, but we understand kind of all the different steps that brought them there. And so I think there's this kind of very interesting distillation of Magneto as this kind of complicated character. As you said, it's kind of meant different things to different people in different times. And it struck me that kind of the reference to him as kind of a being without a country is this kind of, you know, with Magneto, I think by this point, is he explicitly Jewish? That would be kind of 2008 as well. Yeah. So, you know, the idea of kind of being in exile, in a sense, is kind of, I think, tying in with that sense of his kind of identity.
Okay. In high school, this was one of my favorite events of all time. It's the Age of Apocalypse. The lead up to this, Legion is fully himself. He wants his father's attention. He gets the idea that if he can travel back in time and murder Magneto, then his father will have had a happy life and maybe he will have loved me. He instead goes back and accidentally murders Xavier. And then we get the storyline, The Age of Apocalypse, which was so widely beloved to so many people. And it's been, you know, stories still happening in that place once in a while when they reference it. That happens because of Legion. Gabrielle is a prominent part of Legion Quest. She is really trying to take care of her kid. She's recognizing he basically has the powers of a god. We get a series of flashbacks to that old Xavier Magneto meeting years before when Gabrielle was first healed. Legion travels back in time and they do that weird thing where like he's posing as his dad and then it's implied that he sexually assaults his mom. This is a weird like 90s thing where that's like the ultimate way to show that someone is insane or evil. I hate that part of this story so much. It didn't canonically happen except in that other reality, but I still really, really hate it. She's a significant trauma survivor. That's kind of the key pieces of Legion Quest.
I must say, when I got to this one, this is where my kind of my back knowledge of X-Men had been kind of exceeded.
Yeah, we start to spin here.
and which is fine. You know, I think any kind of entry point into superhero comics, you kind of jumping in, and it's kind of, I had the sensation here of sort of diving into cold water, where you kind of, you have to move around a little bit before you get comfortable, and then you can kind of see what's going on. Yeah, I likewise found that the idea of Gabrielle as a survivor of sexual assault, for that to be kind of a plot point is, in any media, I always find that it's very rarely handled well. Yeah. And I don't think it was kind of handled well here, especially when it's used as kind of as a plot point, as a kind of a mechanism to kind of make us feel something about the character, rather than, if this is going to be used appropriately, it should be about the experience of the victim, not about driving the story. So I found that gross. As I say, you know, this is the 90s, and this is when comics were very much tailored towards a kind of particular type of audience, and there was that kind of race towards being as gritty as possible, of kind of pushing boundaries. Of all the different stories, I think that in particular just kind of made me not want to.
Gabrielle very much becomes a bit character over the next section of history, and I'm frankly just not going to name all the issues that she appears in the 90s, and then she's gone for a really long time. But the interesting piece is she sees Operation Zero Tolerance happen, which is where the American government weaponizes, like, we're going to have death robots hunt down mutants now, like on a governmental level. This is the story where she meets Saw Chupacabra. I'll definitely ask your opinion on that one in a moment. She also witnesses Magneto get the country of Genosha. She sees it go through some changes, and then she witnesses from afar the Genosian genocide. We see her working with the UN a little bit in these years, but we don't get a lot of insight into her internal thoughts. But all of these things, from Genosha to the genocide, would of course inspire major thoughts and feelings in this character who doesn't often get the feature. We don't need to talk about their meeting specifically, but the comparison perhaps between Gabrielle Haller and Sabra.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if Sabra might need to be a kind of an entire episode.
Yeah, I would love to have you back and let's talk Sabra sometime.
Yeah. I think this is still the era where I think every time Sabra appears, she seems to kind of just immediately start like giving unsolicited nationalistic statements and references to the Holocaust that kind of no one asked for. There is something about the way that the character is kind of presented is about the kind of a certain kind of ickiness that many in the US kind of felt around the US relationship with Israel.
Yeah.
And she's kind of presented as something of a sort of side of that way. But there isn't necessarily kind of commentary here. It's just that every time she shows up, she'll kind of make some kind of very nationalistic statement, and then everyone around her kind of rolls their eyes, and then the story moves forward. And I think that's a kind of recurring thing with that character. But again, it sort of needs to be contextualized within. When placed in relationship to things that are happening in the world, it sort of makes sense, but the comic doesn't actually kind of make explicit reference. It's just kind of like, oh, here she goes, and then...
Yeah, it also really bothers me that in comics, it's very much become Legion is the son of Professor X, who of course is the superpowered character, but David Haller is the son of Gabrielle Haller. His mother's name is not David Xavier. She is the character that cared about him. Cy Spurrier is an incredible writer. I really enjoy their work. He's done so much with Nightcrawler and Legion over the last several years. There's a series called X-Men Legacy. I love it front to back. This is the template for the show that later becomes Legion. And it's a story from the perspective of David Haller for the first time. The theme of this series is very much him learning how to take responsibility for himself. His tagline basically is, I rule me. He's fighting against his own inner demons and the things that escape from his mind. He's trying to claim his place in the world. He's trying to resolve his trauma. He's an incredible character as portrayed in this series. The covers on this series are all very artsy and new agey. It's a really fun and deep read front to back. When you read a Cy Spurrier comic, you gotta take your time. There's a lot of dialogue. It's all very deep, and I really enjoy it. We're gonna talk most about X-Men Legacy number 15. That'll be kind of the concluding piece of our conversation. But there are moments where you see David reckoning with his trauma a little bit. In issue 5, he calls his mom on the phone but hangs up. In 12, she sees David on the television in one of his adventures. In 14, there's a huge thing in London where David's on a big mission and Pete Wisdom calls in Gabrielle Haller. But the one I want to spend the most time on is The Place of Broken Things, which is a story in X-Men Legacy 15. It's wonderful.
I did enjoy reading them. I don't know if I necessarily, I've been thinking very much about Gabrielle Haller and her kind of status as survivor. And then there is David's kind of second generation survivor. I don't know if I saw a lot of that here. I think it was more kind of about the character and his kind of, I felt like we sort of drifted quite far from what we talked about previously.
But Gabrielle gets a lot of lovely moments in here. I love that he makes her complex. So David welcomes her to Muir Island. Welcome back to Muir Island, Ambassador Haller. Also, nice to see you, Ma. You don't need to be nervous. It's fine. It's all fine. The question I imagine you're groping for is why here? After years, years of precisely zero context betwixt loving Mammy and her poor, lonely wee son, why would he choose as the venue for their joyful reunion the very place where she deserted him? Because that's where she left him to be monitored by Moira in the coma. Gabrielle is stunned. They walk back in the room where Moira had kept him in the coma for all these years, and he says, my childhood home, a bed with restraints. My favorite meal, a coma-inducing IV. My happiest memory, that one special time when an entire week passed without a single fucking person digging into my skull. And Gabrielle's really struggling to relate to him. She has not heard her child talk to her in this way before, you imagine. But she really opens up, and I'm going to read her speech here. This will be my last big dialogue read, everybody, I promise. 4 days ago, I successfully negotiated the secret exchange of a captured Mossad agent for 17 Chechenian prisoners via a mobile reconditioning center in Wales. The locals thought we were filming an episode of Doctor Who. 3 days ago, I stopped a respected British newspaper from running a piece, biased in my opinion, about Israeli settlers in the Palestinian territories by gently reminding them the editor of a certain photos in my possession of his recent vacation in Amsterdam. 2 days ago, I attended the London opening of the Circus purpose of unification, bringing together Jewish and Muslim performers, which moved to tears a mid-level member of the royal family. Yesterday, I did nothing. I had a bath. I drank a glass of wine. I watched a bad film. Real things, dreadful things, beautiful things, but things I understand. You, my son, my poor son, you come from another world, a world of costumes, powers, a world where you're a hero or a villain or nothing in between, a world where people won't stay dead. Your father's world. It scares me, David. I don't understand it. No, that's not it. It's more that I don't believe in it. In fact, the one and only thing I know about your world is that it does not need me. How could I compete? I lost you the moment Charles, dear Charles, learned you were his. That's so precious, that last statement, because she wanted so badly to keep him from Charles, knowing that Charles would consume him. David replies, didn't it ever occur to you I might prefer your world to his? And she hugs him. Oh, my son, I'm sorry, my son, I'm so sorry. And then he shows her his world, like the one in his head where all the vision, the people living there are happy. They confront an errant personality that had sprouted that looked just like Charles, which is a thing in this series, the ghost of his father in his brain. They go back into the real world. Gabrielle told David what Xavier said to her the moment that he learned about David. And that thing was, thank you. And as Gabrielle embraced David, she's then shot in the head by a guy named Black Gold, who's trying to assassinate David. But David kills the man. She reminds him as she's dying that her world is different and she wants to die. These stories, man, that tell you these lovely, heartfelt resolution stories, and then someone's shot in the head at the end. Tell me your thoughts on X-Men Legacy 15.
I wonder how readers at the time kind of would receive that. Like, there's a reference to kind of, you know, the hostage exchange, but then also this idea of her kind of working a kind of campaign about the way in which Israel is kind of represented in foreign press. It reminded me of, or it made me think about kind of when Sabra is presented in certain comics as kind of doing battle with enemies, it's always kind of these kind of cartoonish enemies of kind of sentinels and things like that. And what it's aligning is the kind of the real human cost of the what this is kind of the allegory is kind of hiding so much more than it's actually kind of engaging with. And so I found it interesting, the idea of there being a kind of actual reference to her trying to present the actions of the Israeli military in a way that kind of looks positive in the foreign press, and the idea that this kind of deliberate work of kind of the work that she's doing feels closer to actually referring to kind of reality than we often get with Sabra. But it's only a fleeting moment, and it's not that we actually kind of get a sustained engagement with that.
The man who kills her is an assassin named Black Gold. He's a Muslim character from the fictional country of Akiria. As David reacts, he vaporizes Black Gold, as well as the prince of this country that had ordered the assassination. It's uncomfortable, and it is discussed in the series a little bit, but it's uncomfortable that she's killed by another Muslim character to me, rather than just a run-of-the-mill assassin.
And I wonder, in part, this is kind of the limitation of superhero stories, where if there isn't kind of cartoonish, spectacular violence, then there isn't really a story.
I love two moments in particular in this story, and these are my final two thoughts on this character before we wrap up. Number one, I like that she died. I know that's a terrible thing to say, but I don't need to see this character anymore. And even though her death was not her choice, she got this moment of resolution with her child first. I mean, it's a superhero comic. We need the soap opera. But I kind of like that she's in a restful place. David could have healed her, but she says, I want to go now. The other piece, and this is maybe the most insightful piece to her character that we haven't discussed at all, is the reason she kept the child a secret was Charles Xavier's the guy that went back to America and formed a child army. Like, she didn't want her mutant child to be caught up in that world and wanted to hold on to something that was hers. So this formation she's had of her public life, this world of things she's understanding, she's doing these incredible things on a global level, but her own child she doesn't get and then dies in his arms. I don't know if you have any final thoughts on Gabrielle Haller's ending.
It was interesting to see the entire kind of arc of this character. And I appreciate you kind of guiding me through that. Kind of here's all the sort of points to visit. It made me think, kind of going back to that first issue, the way in which the kind of characters, the character's been sort of developed out. I felt like her first appearance, she plays a very kind of specific plot role without there necessarily being kind of depth to her. And I feel like by the time we get to the end, particularly her kind of that sentiment of kind of being ready to go, I found quite interesting. I sort of started by trying to kind of reconcile that first version of the character with the version we get later on. And then I realized that might not necessarily be be kind of the right way to approach it.
You know, when you create a character in the Marvel Universe, it's now in the giant toy box of characters available to people. It would be so easy for some writer tomorrow to put Gabrielle Haller in a story not knowing that she died, for example, and then people go, wait, what is that? I mean, that's how superhero comics work. It's over decades and there's hundreds and hundreds of people involved at any given moment. I like this character. I love covering the stuff that I've covered, but I don't want to move backward, right? I don't want to cover that stuff again. And one of the biggest reliefs was covering Magneto's trauma background. We spent a month on that on my show, which I want to make like a joyful place, but those old stories about the concentration camps are rough. This is a character I've been wanting to talk about for a while. We've examined a lot about Xavier and Magneto and their families, but this is an integral character, even though we have not gotten to the introduction of Legion yet. I love this character. I often ask people, what's the story you want to see of her? I'm okay with what we've seen. I'm thrilled that she's generally seen in a complicated, positive light. I'm thrilled that we've got to see the complexity of her relationship with both David and Charles on the page, but I had enough of that as well. I don't need to see a lot more digging into those stories. Is there anything you feel is unresolved for Gabrielle?
The kind of foundational idea of the character is that she is a Holocaust survivor. But the extent to which that is explored, is, as we've said, is kind of really kind of captured in a single page. I don't know if comics are, given the kind of conventions of the format and or the superhero genre, I don't know if we necessarily kind of needed more than we've got. I felt like the greater an attempt to unpack that, the more risk there is of kind of misrepresenting or unnecessary kind of sentimentalizing or trying to kind of draw that into a 3-act structure. I'm okay with the character that being her backstory. We get the one page and now she is part of something else. I enjoyed reading her arc and like, getting to know the character.
I loved reading her arc. I especially enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for all of the insight and perspective you brought. And thank you. Anytime I'm asking someone to do homework, that's always a huge but I really appreciate it. And I hope it was a fun experience. I would love to have you back on. It'd be a little while, but let's talk about Sabra sometime. I want things to settle down politically a little bit, but I think you'd be a perfect person to have that conversation with. She's complicated.
Doing the homework distracted me from scheduling for a little while, so I appreciate that.
I understand. I'm prepping for shows all the time. Philip, what a genuine delight to meet you. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope this was insightful. We talked about trauma stuff, so as always, take care of yourself if you are in a space where you need to do that. But I appreciate so much your time and talents today, Philip. Thank you. We'll see you guys all back here next time on the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.